From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is Tariq Ali here with Amy Goodman at Democracy Now!, waiting to hear from a former friend, Christopher Hitchens, now consultant to the White House, I gather.
Today, the big debate, postponed liberation or recolonization, a debate on the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, between authors Tariq Ali and Christopher Hitchens. But first, they never built a bomb, never hijacked an airliner, and as far as the Justice Department can determine, never made any plans to commit an act of terrorism. Yet the Lackawanna Six are going to jail. The first of them was sentenced yesterday.
These individuals are not have not been convicted of engaging in terrorism. They haven't been convicted of conspiring to engage in terrorism. They haven't been convicted of providing material support to terrorist activity. They have been convicted of providing material support to an organization designated as a terrorist organization. And
all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Tanzania, an international court has convicted three Rwandan journalists of genocide for encouraging the mass killing of hundreds of thousands of Tutsis in Rwanda. One newspaper urged citizens to exterminate the, quote, cockroach Tutsis. A radio station featured DJs who would recite the phrase, go to work, the graves are not yet full, over the airwaves. It's estimated that Rwanda's Hutu majority killed about 800,000 Tutsis between April and July of 1994. Two of the journalists were sentenced to life terms. Another was sentenced to 35 years. The Washington-based lawyer John Floyd, who defended one of the journalists, said the verdict was unfair and a setback for freedom of the press. The court ruled, quote, the power of the media to create and destroy human values comes with great responsibility. Those who control the media are accountable for its consequences. In news from Iraq, the New York Times is reporting U.S. officials have rejected a plan for Iraqi officials to conduct a quick census of the country's population that would allow Iraq to hold national elections in 9 months. This comes at a time when the U.S. is arguing the lack of a census is a reason why direct elections cannot be held. The Washington Post is also reporting that the United States is moving forward with plans to create an Iraqi paramilitary force made up of fighters mostly from Shiite and Kurdish political parties that back the U.S. occupation. At least one member of the Iraqi Governing Council opposes the plan. Ghazi Yawartol, the Washington Post, quote, we should be dissolving militias, not finding ways to legitimize them. This sends the wrong message to the Iraqi people. A new poll by the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland has found that 7 out of 10 Americans believe the war in Iraq did not reduce the threat of terrorism. In Cincinnati, a coroner has ruled that Nathaniel Jones died from injuries sustained when police beat him repeatedly on Sunday. A video of the beating showed that officers repeatedly beat the unarmed Jones, who is African American, with metal nightsticks while it appeared he resisted arrest. An attorney representing Jones' family said the man was trying to give up when he was beaten. Up until now, police officials had suggested the cause of his death was not the beating, but either a heart problem or an overdose of drugs. The coroner said that although the beating was the primary cause of death, it should not be interpreted to imply the police behaved improperly. The Washington-based Council on American-Islamic Relations is suing North Carolina Republican Congressmember Cass Ballinger for defamation. In October, Ballinger described the organization as, quote, the fundraising arm for Hezbollah, and claimed that the stress caused by living near CARE's Washington office after 9/11 led to the end of his marriage. In Cairo, 12 Palestinian groups are meeting in an effort to reach an agreement on a conditional ceasefire with Israel. A state judge in Colorado has the state's new school voucher law ruled it unconstitutional, saying it illegally strips local school boards of control over education. In Buffalo, a Yemeni American was sentenced to 10 years in prison yesterday for visiting a Taliban-run training camp before September 11th. One of six men from Lackawanna, New York, to plead guilty to providing material support to a terrorist organization. Meanwhile, a federal court in San Francisco struck down portions of that same law. We'll have more on this story in a few minutes. And 80 Republican members of Congress are backing an effort to replace the face of Franklin Delano Roosevelt with that of Ronald Reagan. The bill's chief sponsor, Congressman Mark Sauder of Indiana, said it is particularly fitting to honor the Freedom President on this particular piece of coinage because President Reagan was wounded under the left arm by a bullet that had ricocheted and flattened to the size of a dime.
They used to tell me I was building a tree. And so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job.
Brother, can you spare a dime? Lyrics by Yip Harburg, who was blacklisted during the 1950s. This was sung by Tom Waits. I'm Amy Goodman here, Democracy Now! War and Peace Report with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
It's great to be with you all. I've just returned from Buffalo, meeting with people from around the area on the day that a very significant case is being weighed there, sentencing there, but also being looked at around the country.
Yes, and we're going to start off with that one. A federal judge yesterday sentenced a Yemeni American to 10 years in prison for supporting a terrorist organization. Mukhtar al-Bakari is the first of the so-called Lackawanna Six members to be sentenced after pleading guilty earlier this year to providing material support or resources to a foreign terrorist organization, a charge carrying a maximum of 10 years in prison and $250,000 fine. None of the six have been accused of planning or engaging in any act of terrorism. All six have admitted to the FBI and intelligence officials that in 2001 they traveled to Afghanistan, received training at a camp run by the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, and heard speeches by Al-Qaeda's leader Osama bin Laden.
A lawyer for one of the men said they pleaded guilty only after prosecutors had dropped heavy hints that they would be declared enemy combatants if they didn't. Enemy combatant status places a detainee outside civilian justice system where access to legal counsel is guaranteed. The lawyer said, quote, it was a factor my client took into account. He was worried about it. I think it's an improper use of the procedure. First of all, he said, I think it's pretty heavy-handed. The other five defendants in the case are scheduled to be sentenced later this month. The prosecution has been hailed as a triumph for law enforcement by President Bush, Attorney General John Ashcroft, FBI Director Robert Mueller, but critics are calling it an example of America putting people in jail for thought crimes and guilt by association. This comes as the San Francisco-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled part of the law that the men are charged under unconstitutional. We turn now to David Cole, who is standing by at an airport headed out to New Mexico. David Cole, a professor at Georgetown Law School and author of the book Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedom in the War on Terrorism. Can you talk about the significance of this case?
The Justice Department sort of puts it forward as the centerpiece of their domestic criminal war on terrorism. But when you look at the facts, you really have to wonder, if this is the centerpiece, what is this war all about? Because these individuals are not have not been convicted of engaging in terrorism. They haven't been convicted of conspiring to engage in terrorism. They haven't been convicted of providing material support to terrorist activity. They have been convicted of providing material support to an organization designated as a terrorist organization. And under the statute that they were convicted, there is no requirement that the government make any showing that your support, that your activity had any connection whatsoever with any terrorist activity of the group in question. And it matters not what your intent is. So even if their account is true, which namely that they went to this camp in response to this charismatic religious leader, and they found themselves in a place they didn't want to be, and they never wanted to have anything to do with it when they came back, which the facts seem to support, they're still guilty under this law because it's so so broadly written.
What about the Court of Appeals decision coming down just about the same time as the sentencing yesterday?
Well, that's right. This case, Humanitarian Law Project versus Ashcroft, is a case that I did with the Center for Constitutional Rights, in which we challenged the very statute that the Lackawanna Six were convicted of violating. And the court in California has declared the very provision that the Lackawanna Six were convicted of unconstitutional. That is the provision that makes it a crime to provide personnel or training to a designated terrorist group. The Ninth Circuit has now unanimously declared unconstitutional. So these guys in Lackawanna have pled guilty to a statute that a federal court of appeals has declared unconstitutional. And the case in California, I think, illustrates the breadth of this statute. We represent the Humanitarian Law Project, which is a established human rights group that had been providing human rights advocacy training and peacemaking negotiation assistance to the Kurdistan Workers Party in Turkey, which represents the Kurds. And they were doing so in order to encourage the Kurdistan Workers Party to resolve their disputes with Turkey over the status of the Kurds through lawful means rather than through violent means. Yet once the Kurdistan Workers Party was put on the list as a designated terrorist group, it became a crime for this human rights organization to encourage it to engage in nonviolence, to provide it with assistance in peacemaking, to train it in human rights advocacy. And so the Ninth Circuit held that statute is so overbroad and so vague that it penalizes core First Amendment-protected speech and advocacy and therefore must be struck down.
We're talking to David Cole, Georgetown University law professor, who is at the airport, so sorry for the phone sound, heading to Albuquerque, talking about this precedent-setting case in Lackawanna right now, which is just next to Buffalo, New York. I was there yesterday. Six people have pleaded guilty to a law, parts of which have now been struck down in pleaded guilty to violating a law, parts of which have been struck down by the Court of Appeals in San Francisco. Juan?
David, in this article, they never built a bomb, never hijacked an airliner, and as far as the U.S. Justice Department can determine, never made any plans to commit any act of terrorism. But the local Yemeni Americans known as the Lackawanna Six are all going to prison in a case that has ignited much debate. How is it possible? What does this mean?
Well, I think it's possible because after the Oklahoma City bombing, we enacted this extremely broad statute that essentially resurrects the principle of guilt by association. Before 1996, it was a crime to engage in terrorism or to provide support, material support, to any terrorist activity. But what they did in 1996 is they expanded the law to say it's a crime to support any organization which the Secretary of State puts on a list as a terrorist group without regard to what your actual conduct, what your actual support consists of. So if this law had been on the books in the 1980s, for example, the tens of thousands of Americans who made donations to the African National Congress to support its lawful anti-apartheid work would be prosecutable as providing material support to a terrorist group because the ANC was designated as a terrorist group by the State Department every year until it came to power in South Africa. So this is a guilt by association law, and it's very tempting to the administration because it does not require them to prove that people are actually engaged in any terrorist activity. But for that very reason, it's extremely dangerous because innocent people, people who have no intent to engage in any kind of a terrorist activity at all, can be held liable.
In a related issue, David, front page of the New York Times today, sudden shift on detainee allowing legal access may give legal cover. And it says, when the Pentagon said this week it would let an American being hailed as an enemy combatant meet a lawyer, which it had refused to do for months, it appeared on the surface to be a major concession to the critics of the policy of detaining terrorism suspects. In fact, is there meaningful contact between the lawyer and the so-called enemy combatant?
Well, that remains to be seen, of course, but I don't think it's a huge concession. I mean, what the military said was, we still maintain that Yasser Hamdi has no right to talk to a lawyer, but since we have now been interrogating him for about 2 years incommunicado without a lawyer, and we have now determined that we've extracted every piece of information that we could possibly get from him, we will now, in our discretion, allow him to talk to his lawyer. I think it was an attempt by the military to sort of make their actions appear more reasonable in view of the fact that it's very likely the Supreme Court will be reviewing the legality of the detention of Yasser Hamdi. The fact that the court agreed to hear the case of the Guantanamo detainees means that it's very likely that they will hear the case of Yasser Hamdi, an American citizen being held in under similar conditions. And I think the administration is worried, worried that they may well lose this authority, and they want to therefore make it look as reasonably applied as possible in the context of the Supreme Court assessing its legality.
How would this have impact on the Supreme Court deciding on Hamdi? Would that short-circuit that or not?
Well, it is possible that it might lead the Supreme Court to remand the case because now he's had a chance to talk to his lawyer. They might say, well, then the court should allow him, his lawyer, to make a presentation on Hamdi's behalf based on those communications. So it might delay the ruling, but I think more importantly,
wouldn't that be then a possibility that the Bush administration is just trying to avoid having the court make a decision on these enemy combatants?
Absolutely. That's one possibility. And the other possibility is, even if the court is going to address the question, we want the court to address it in a context where the government looks like it is acting reasonably with the power that it is asserting. And so I think, the planned, what's reported planned release of a significant number of Guantanamo detainees is also in line with that. They want to, they're very nervous about losing this authority, and so they want to be perceived as acting reasonably with the authority, but they're only, they're only acting reasonably to the extent they're acting reasonably at all, out of a concern that they might lose the authority altogether.
David Cole, we want to thank you very much for being with us of Georgetown University Law School, speaking to us from the airport before he takes off. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Amy.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Tariq Ali versus Christopher Hitchens. Stay with us.
على طول هو ذكريات كل اللي فات فاكره يا بلدي قلبي مليان بحكايات فاكره يا بلدي اول حب كان في بلدي مش ممكن انساه يا بلدي فين ايام زمان قبل الوداع
Dalida here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. It's been 8 months since the U.S. began its invasion of Iraq. In this time, U.S. forces have failed to produce any weapons of mass destruction in the country, the stated reason for going to war with Baghdad. According to the Pentagon's own figures, some 440 U.S. troops have died in Iraq.
There are no solid estimates of the number of Iraqis who have been killed since the start of the invasion. November was the bloodiest month for U.S. forces in Iraq. 79 died, 39 of them killed in the downing of four separate military helicopters. Saddam Hussein remains at large, and the occupation forces face regular attacks throughout the country.
Today, we're going to take a look at the U.S. occupation of Iraq with two renowned authors. Christopher Hitchens, columnist with Vanity Fair and author of A Long, Short War, The Postponed Liberation of Iraq, as well as Tariq Ali, author of the new book Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq, also author of The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity. And maybe that's what we can call this debate, The Clash of Fundamentalisms. Why don't we begin with Tariq Ali in our studio? Can you assess right now the occupation of Iraq?
I think most journalists, even those who are sort of supporting the war, must be aware that in terms of what the United States hoped to achieve, it's a total mess. It's been a disaster, this occupation. It is not popular in Iraq, including with large numbers of people who were deeply hostile to the former regime. The resistance grows daily. The last count the CIA gave us was that the guerrilla army resisting the occupation consists of 50,000 people. The figures the Iraqi opposition gives are a bit higher. They say 80 to 90,000 people, but even the figure of 50,000 is pretty large. And there are about 44 different resistance organizations. I think what we're seeing in Iraq is the classic first stage guerrilla warfare to resist an occupation. We've seen this before in different parts of the world, and the personnel are different, but the pattern is basically the same. And the question now is when Will the United States get out of Iraq? What face-saving devices will it need? The United Nations, in my opinion, won't work because of its history in Iraq. The Europeans are not prepared, the Germans and French, to go along and, save the United States at the present time. So what is President Bush going to do before the next election? This is a pretty important subject for them domestically now, because it's going wrong. And the what is reported sometimes in the U.S. press, not very regularly, though the Associated Press reports on this are very strong, of a very severe demoralization inside the ranks of the U.S. Army, who are discovering that this war was not at all about liberation. That the Iraqis do not regard it as such, apart from a tiny handful, and that they are extremely unpopular. What many soldiers talk about in interviews when they come on furlough is that what they can't bear is the anger, the bitterness, the hatred on the face of many ordinary Iraqis, not the people who are hurling stones or firing bullets at them. And this is something which is creating health breakdowns now in the United States Army. So what we are seeing, curiously enough, in Iraq is a very telescoped situation. The resistance has been very quick. The demoralization is there. And Bush himself is very unpopular, even in countries which historically have been very close to the United States. I don't talk now about the Arab world. I talk about Europe and the Far East.
Christopher Hitchens, when you came back from Iraq, you wrote in Vanity Fair, "I was quite startled by how well it was going," referring to the occupation.
Yes. Let me try and list some of the things that have improved out of recognition. This is not an appeal to your green listeners, Amy, I promise you, but I'll just start with it because it's at the front of my mind at the moment. The reflooding of the environment of the Marshalls in the south, the largest wetlands in the Middle East, which were first drained and then dried out and burned by Saddam Hussein, you could see the smoke from the space shuttle, was a very touching thing to see. And as for the faces of the inhabitants when Americans turned up, which I witnessed, one couldn't really ask for more in point of a welcome, signs of which I also saw very noticeably in the south, in the holy cities of to the Shia of Kabul and Najaf, and of course in Kurdistan in the north. Don't know why the left fails to mention the Kurds as often as it does, but you know, people want the 4th of July to be the national holiday, more or less. Now, in the areas which of which this is not true, then I should add that in Baghdad, I'm a journalist. It pleases me to see the reopening of the Free Press, the publication that your first newspaper onto the streets was by the Iraqi Communist Party, but there are about 20 new newspapers now. Publishing has resumed. Almost everyone now can get and has got a satellite dish. They're back in touch with the modern world. Things like that that I don't think are negligible, to say nothing of the opening of the mass graves, which probably contain 300,000 Iraqis, the beginning of an investigation into that, and the breaking open of the secret prisons. And yes, the finding of, for example, the elements of a nuclear centrifuge in the garden of Mehdi Obeidi, one of the Qasai Hussein science team, and the discovery on disks of Saddam's most recent attempt, very recent, to buy weaponry missiles off the shelf from North Korea, something which I told you was going to happen in my book, The Long Short War. Of course, there was a weapon of mass destruction program. It's just been interrupted and now terminated. I somewhat wish Tariq would not act as if he didn't know better when he describes those who don't like this as a resistance. They're members of a former regular force. They're not really guerrillas. These are people who were part of the police and security organs of the Ba'ath Party, augmented by some of the Bin Ladenite underworld. And if these people are allowed to win or indeed make any further progress, then all the things that were predicted wrongly by the anti-war movement, such as a mass exodus of refugees, humanitarian crisis, total social breakdown, ethnic and confessional civil war and fratricide, all of those things will unfailingly occur in Iraq if the so-called resistance is not militarily defeated, which I think, by the way, I'm not a military strategist, and I do know, and I don't dispute, that there are enormous reverses being experienced on this point, but I actually think that the likelihood of a military defeat of the American expedition is negligible.
Tariq Ali.
Well, let's go through all this. First, it's an open fact. I mean, you know, it's reported in the U.S. press that there have been big mobilizations in Basra, Najaf, Samarra. These are all cities, the first two in the south. Samarra, there's a recent clash, one of the holiest of holy Shia cities. And the people killed by the United States were basically civilians. Just 2 days ago, including Iranian pilgrims on their way to the site of the hidden imam. And it's just foolish of Christopher to pretend otherwise. You know, every single report coming out, by and large, except from those who are apologists of the Bush administration, indicate great growing unease and growing support for the resistance. Look, this resistance is not simply remnants of the old regime, and for that matter, there are many remnants of the old regime collaborating with the United States, as is the Iraqi Communist Party, which made its first big mistake when it decided to collaborate with Saddam Hussein, and it's now made its second big mistake, which is depriving people of a secular voice hostile to the occupation in the cities, which is opening the road to confessional groups in that part of the world. No one disputes that Saddam was a brutal dictator. That's never been in doubt. I mean, you know, who ever disputed that? The point is, and the point we've made, is that Saddam was at his worst, and the mass graves being found are graves which go back to the period of the Iran-Iraq war, when he was a close ally of the West, and Rumsfeld was visiting him on behalf of Reagan, and the United States and Britain were arming him. That is also the time when the attacks on the Kurds were at their most vicious. It's not that one doesn't write about the Kurds, one does. They change sides quite regularly. I mean, you know, this is a fact, Christopher knows it well. They've taken money from Iran, they've taken money from Israel, the Kurdish leaders have, they've taken money from Saddam, they've taken money from the United States. That doesn't mean that they're reliable allies. They act as they see it, like the United States does, in their own interests. And if they see that the United States is shifting or bringing the Turkish army in, the Kurds too will be in rebellion. So the resistance is far, far bigger, with the exception of the Kurds, who are not yet in open rebellion, than he's prepared to acknowledge. As for the notion that Al-Qaeda is operating, there's been no evidence of that. This is, even the Pentagon propaganda is quite careful. Recently, a U.S. general in Baghdad was shown on the European television screens saying that he had found no evidence whatsoever of any Qaeda, and the people fighting them were largely Iraqis. And what else can one call them if not a resistance? When a country is occupied, in the Arab world and elsewhere, normally people don't like being occupied. It's just a fact of life. They may loathe Saddam Hussein, but they don't like being occupied. And if this occupation carries on, as Bush said on his visit to the Philippines, that the model for Iraq was the Philippines, which is a crazy thing to say, because that occupation lasted 47 years. The United States abandoned the Philippines in 1946. It still has amongst, or had till recently, amongst the largest U.S. military bases there. So I think this is going to end badly, alas, for everyone. I agree that the United States can't be militarily defeated, not simply by the Iraqis, but by any other country in the world. So military defeat is impossible. And even in Vietnam, let's face it, they could have, if they'd wanted to, won militarily by using nuclear weapons. But they didn't do it because of the political price they would have to pay. It's not the military defeat that is in question. It's what the long-term effects of this war will produce in the region itself. And in the United States, already it's the resistance which is actually permitting Democratic politicians to open their mouths. They'd lost their tongues for a long, long time to come. And one shouldn't forget that we now have two concurrent occupations in the Arab East. One is the continuing Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has now been added to by the United States occupation of Iraq. And this is, it's not going to end well for anyone. Unfortunately, that is the situation.
Christopher Hitchens, I'd like to ask you, the Bush administration is in a quandary that's continuing to grow, that on the one hand, it says that it came to Iraq for to liberate the Iraqi people and pave the way for democracy. But on the other hand, it doesn't want to deal with the possibility of a quick democratic vote that would lead to the Shiite and Islamic-run government in Iraq. What about that contradiction of the occupation claiming it wants democracy but not being able to deal with it immediately?
Well, look, I'll phrase that, if I may, as part of a reply to Tariq, who said that it was only as a result of the resistance that Iraqi civilian or democratic politicians opened their mouths. That's really not true. I mean, I know some of these people, and they've been saying very loudly and publicly ever since the coalition forces landed that they wanted the swiftest possible transition to an Iraqi civilian government. And Mr. Bremer may have changed his mind because of the military situation. And I have a fear, not dissimilar from Tariq's, actually, that the Bush administration may be changing its mind for similar reasons, that this is determined by the famous exit strategy consideration. The obstacles, of course, are that, well, for one thing, I don't see how you can have a vote until you've had something like a census. There hasn't been a decent census in Iraq for a good deal of time. It would be possible, I'm told by Patrick Coburn, someone known to both Tariq Ali and myself, very good reporter in the area, to do a quick census based simply on the ration card system of the Ba'ath Party, which in a rough way gave people gave an idea of how many people there were, how many members of each family, and so forth, and how stuff was to be doled out to them by the state. I think that would be a rather meager way of doing it. It might be necessary rather than give any impression of postponing a democratic election. But now I'll just have to reply to a couple of the things that were said before. I would be the last one to deny, indeed I was one of the first ones to affirm, that many of Saddam's worst atrocities took place at a time when he was an unofficial ally of the West. Indeed, one of the reasons I support this policy is that it is at least partly a cancellation of that and makes up for it to some extent. It isn't true to say that all those mass graves go back to the Iran-Iraq War. The one I visited in Hila in the south near Babylon was filled in the days immediately after the last Gulf War, as a matter of fact, at the time of the rebellion, which had the impression, or its leaders and participants had the impression, was going to be supported by the coalition. And many of us who are for regime change feel that the original sin, if you like, was not to support that rebellion and have done with Saddam Hussein in 1991, in which case we'd now be something like 14 years into nation building instead of just beginning. A lot of good people who are now dead would still be alive, and one must add the corollary, a lot of bad people who are alive would now be dead. Look at the atrocity the Americans committed in Samarra, the one that Tariq began with. Look at the outrage of it. They're bringing into the town the new money that's been printed, a new Iraqi dinar that doesn't have the face of a psychopathic megalomaniac on it, and that will one day probably be worth something and perhaps even become a convertible currency. That's the new dinar. Obviously, in these circumstances or any other, if you're going to move that amount of currency around, you have to do it under fairly heavy guard. That would be true in any city. As it gets into the middle of town, it's attacked. The clear hope of those who do this is that the crossfire will result in civilian casualties, which will then be resented. Iraqi society is very paranoid for any number of good and bad reasons. It's quite easy to spread rumors and distortions, and that's how it arises. But really, you have to understand what these forces, if you want to call them the resistance, are doing. They shot down a senior and respected Ayatollah outside his place of worship. They shot down in the street one of the female members of the governing council. They murdered the UN envoy in his office, who had been responsible for the democratic transition in East Timor. The eventual and long postponed transition in East Timor, as Amy knows. They killed the staff of the Jordanian embassy. The list goes on and on like that. I think it's pretty obvious what they are from what they do.
Tariq Ali.
Well, we can go on, you know, till the cows come home on this one. I mean, obviously, when a resistance decides to fight or resist an occupation, It uses all these tactics, exactly the same things, and the same methods were used by the Algerians in the Algerian War against the French.
Oh,
yes, Christopher, you forget. No, my dear fellow.
Murdering female members of the Provisional Democratic Government.
I'm afraid a Provisional Democratic Government, a pack of collaborators and quislings put there by the occupation. They have absolute no legitimacy whatsoever.
Well, we'll the hold Vietnam, you to that.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, you may try and alter that. The Iraqis may have.
You. No, sir. We'll hold you to that.
Okay, yeah. You certainly may hold me to that. I mean, what about the Vietnamese? How many people from the South Vietnamese puppet regime did they knock off? How many cafes did they blow up in Saigon without a whimper of protest from you? Because you supported that. I mean, and in 91. Some of your writings against that particular war were amongst your most cogent, and they still apply. Just because you've changed doesn't mean that the Iraqi resistance should develop tactics in line with what the Bush administration desires. These tactics have been pretty successful. And look, the fact that they blew up the UN building in a country where two senior UN officials resigned in anger and disgust at what the UN itself was doing for 12 years when it administered the sanctions on behalf of the United States and Britain. And even Associated Press reporters walking along the streets of Baghdad and Basra and getting vox pops, people said, we don't care about the UN because of what they did to us. These are not people who are supporters of Saddam Hussein.
Well, can I take you up on that?
I'm going to interrupt for 1 second. You can, but just in a minute. We are hearing a discussion between Tariq Ali, who is the author of Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq, his previous book, The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity. Also on the line with us from Washington, D.C., Christopher Hitchens, columnist with Vanity Fair, author of A Long Short War, The Postponed Liberation of Iraq. We'll be back with the two of them in a minute. Drummers of the Nile here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Christopher Hitchens, columnist with Vanity Fair, author of A Long Short War, The Postponed Liberation of Iraq, and Tariq Ali, just in from Britain, author of Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. Juan?
Yeah, Christopher, I'd like to ask you, what about this issue that Tariq Ali raises about the dramatic turnaround in your positions and viewpoints since the 1991 Gulf War in terms of how the U.S. is dealing with Iraq?
Well, I changed my mind on this at the end of that war, as a matter of fact. She's right. I wrote and spoke a good deal about it and in criticism of Bush Sr.'s policy and indeed of the origins of the war, which I thought was very shady. A lot of that I wouldn't take back, by the way, but I visited various bits of the region during the war, and I ended the war in northern Iraq, driving around with the Kurdish guerrillas who'd begun to be able to form something like their own autonomy under the canopy of American and British protection, the so-called Operation Provide Comfort. And the guys I was driving with had a picture of George Bush sellotaped to the front of their Jeep. And I said to them, look, you know, half joking, I said, look, I might run into someone I know while we're doing this. You have to have this picture here. And they said, well, yeah, we do. We like him because if it wasn't for him, we'd all be dead. And I realized that I didn't really have an answer to that question or to that point. I began to sort of rethink my position on it a bit. And I I think that it would have been better to complete the eviction of the Saddam Hussein regime from power, that the compromise that was reached, which was to protect the Kurds and the Shia from further genocidal reprisals, was correct. And it seemed to imply that, also implied a sort of ongoing state of war with Ba'athism. And that leads me, if I may, to Tariq's point, the one I was trying to intervene on when we took our break. The sanctions regime was, in a way, the worst compromise of all. And a huge amount of damage was done to Iraqi society on the faint but unspoken promise that they weren't going to go on just punishing the people for the sins of the regime. The Oil for Palaces program, as it's become known. But they were holding out the promise of an eventual regime change, which was belatedly kept. When Tariq mentions the street opinion after the bombing of the UN headquarters that we could care less about the UN, it isn't just because of the sanctions, I should add. I mean, I've heard that opinion too. People do resent the UN's administration of the sanctions, but they also resent the UN's obstruction of the removal of Saddam Hussein and the long record of collaboration between the UN and the Ba'ath Party. It's a complexity that I think ought not to be missed. Now, I'll just have to say that I, as Tariq points out, I supported the Algerian and the Vietnamese revolutions enthusiastically and see no reason to revisit that position at all. But it just isn't the case that the Algerian forces would have, the FLN would have, for example, shot down Ayatollah Hakim outside his mosque in Kabul. And I don't think it's the case either that they would have tried to kill the United Nations envoys. It was actually the UN that helped to bring about and broker independence for Algeria. No, it's a slander on the NLF to say that they just put bombs randomly in cafes in Saigon. They didn't. That's part of the reason why they won, why they had popular support, was that their guerrilla tactics, which revolved over a very long period of time, from fighting the French and then the Japanese, and then the renewed French, and then the American interventions. In other words, an evolution entirely different from that of the Fedayeen Saddam, or the Ansar al-Islam, which is, by the way, openly is, if not an al-Qaeda group, a pro-Bin Laden group. If this distinction can't be seen, then it must be my failure in words to point out the difference.
Really? Terrible.
Well, I'm really delighted to hear that Christopher isn't going back on his support for the Algerian resistance in Vietnam, because this was my worry, that he would go down the whole David Horowitz route, and I'm glad he isn't. I really am genuinely very pleased. But I think he's wrong on that, because if you know, one forgets, but very recently I went and checked out a lot of stuff on the Algerian resistance, and I'm, you know, there were no equivalents. Every single group in Iraq, just to get this out of the way, is denying it had anything to do with the killing of Ayatollah Hakim. The Iranian government came close to alleging that it was the United States, which I don't believe, because it would be such a crazy thing if they had done it, even by mistake. So no group is admitting to who's done it. We don't know who it was, whether it was internal factions within the Shiite organizations or what. So leaving that aside, if you look at the tactics being used by the Iraqi resistance, they are fairly classic tactics, you know, hitting where they can, punishing the occupying forces, punishing those collaborating with them. This was done in Algeria very, very systematically, and even more systematically in Vietnam. I agree. There is no equivalent of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam in Iraq today, or the FLN of Algeria in Iraq. But I'm told, in fact, I have it on good authority, that a meeting took place to try and set up a National Democratic Front of Iraq, consisting of large numbers of organizations, including sections of the Ba'ath, but one shouldn't forget that Saddam also wiped out elements of the Ba'ath Party who opposed him, who didn't want to wage war on Iran. Many of them were either killed or locked up. And many of these people are out again, and they certainly don't want to return to Saddam. In fact, if Saddam Hussein died a natural death or was captured and killed or whatever, the resistance, far from dying down, would actually increase, because many who are not coming out at the moment, fearful that Saddam might come back, would then join the resistance. I have absolutely no doubt of that. So the notion that if we just capture the headman, it's classic colonial talk, capture the headman, get rid of him, and the natives will be on side. It's gone.
Well, nobody is, except that nobody's saying that.
No, lots of people have been saying it, that the key problem is to capture Saddam and destroy him. I mean, that's not going to work.
Well, I don't think it's without importance that Saddam Hussein be brought to justice, and I very much hope that you, like me, wish to see him on trial. In fact, it's one of the vices of the coalition policy, one that I've pointed out myself several times, that no indictment of Saddam Hussein was ever issued, though the ingredients of such indictment could be wheeled off right off the shelf in Kenan Makiya's office in Cambridge, our old comrade, if you remember.
Christopher Hitchens, let me ask a question. Oh, yeah, since you wrote the trial of Henry Kissinger, yeah, talking about him guilty of war crimes, would you say, as you call for Saddam Hussein to be tried for war crimes, that George Bush Sr. should also, for working to support Saddam Hussein through a number of the atrocities that you say he did commit?
Well, I don't think that would actually bear a direct indictment on him, but I do think it's the reason why there's been a foot dragging about this indictment. I'll cut short what I was going to say before. I mean, the reason why it hasn't been done is because so many of the best documented atrocities, mass murder with genocidal intent, torture, aggression, and so forth, were committed when Saddam Hussein was the recipient of Western favor and protection. And that's obviously the dead silence that surrounds that subject. Mm.
I also wanted to follow up on an issue you raised earlier, Tariq Ali, talking about the occupation, Israel's occupation of Gaza and West Bank, and the what you call the parallel occupation Iraq in the U.S. and Iraq. And have you comment on that, Christopher Hitchens?
Well the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza is condemned by international law. And the people who resist it are not, by that condemnation, entitled to use any methods that they like, but they are entitled to resist. That seems to me to make a very clear parallel. Seems to me rather to suggest nothing of a parallel with the liberation of Iraq.
But I
wasn't quite sure how your question was phrased. You want me to comment on the occupation in Palestine?
But in many parts of the Arab world, certainly, as well as in the West, the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the continuing siding of the United States with Israel on the Palestine issue seem inextricably linked.
Yes, no. Well, they are in a way inextricably linked, though they can also be considered separately. I mean, I used to think, for example, that it would be a very big mistake for the United States to intervene in Iraq before it had sponsored a two-state settlement in Palestine. It seems to be just on grounds of consistency. And this was a point often made by the anti-war movement, but you can look at it the other way around if you like. If you say to Saddam Hussein, there's nothing we can do about your regime and the manifold dangers it presents to its people and its neighbors and the ongoing atrocity of its existence until we've settled the longest and most outstanding problem in the region. And that obviously would give Saddam Hussein rather a long lease on life. It would also give him an incentive to disrupt any such solution. And as we know, and as is never denied, the Ba'ath Party boasted of the military and financial help it was giving to the Islamic rejectionists in Gaza and in the West Bank, the suicide bombers, precisely for that reason. So the two things can be considered separately, even if the more complacent elements, more self-satisfied elements of Arab public opinion would like to, for self-righteousness reasons, consider them under the same heading. I wouldn't want to overstate what I'm about to say or have it misrepresented, but George Bush, the current president, that's to say, is the first American president to have used the words Palestinian and state in the same sentence and several times. And I certainly think that a second term for him is much more likely to lead to pressure being brought upon the Israelis than the election of any feasible or possible Democratic candidate. As you must have noticed, all the Democratic candidates for the office are in an auction to see which of them can be the most uncritically pro-Israeli. And I might also add that Paul Wolfowitz in the last few weeks has announced that he wants to meet with the Yossi Beilin Abu Allah forces, who recently had their meeting in Geneva and has been very publicly critical of Israeli settlement policy. So it's a great deal more likely that the regime change forces in the case of Iraq in Washington will be helpful in the solution of the Israel-Palestine dispute than it is likely that a victory for the Fedayeen Saddam in Iraq would be a gift to the region or of any help to the Palestinians.
Tariq Ali.
Well, Christopher carries on referring to them as the Fedayeen Saddam, which they don't do themselves, which the...
Well, I wouldn't if I was them.
No, but you know, they don't do it for a good reason, that they are not the Fedayeen Saddam. To deny the Iraqi people the right to resist an occupation which they don't like is quite incredible. I mean, you know, we will see what happens over the next...
we're going to have an election, aren't we, which the resistance is not calling for.
Well, they should be calling for it, and if a political
Come on, you're making me lose patience now.
Don't be stupid and arrogant. Control yourself. Control yourself. Just control yourself and let me finish. I didn't interrupt you when you were waffling on, Christopher, and you know, I did not interrupt you. Just listen, okay? If a political organization emerges close to the resistance, which is being talked about, one of their demands, I'm pretty sure, will be the election of a constituent assembly. The question is this. Recently, the chairman of the Republican Party abroad said in a public debate with me on television she was in favor of democracy but not in favor of elections, which someone like you, who is, you know, very knowledgeable about Orwellian doublespeak, will appreciate. You cannot have democracy without elections. If you have elections, you will be faced with an immediate problem. When I say you, I mean the U.S. administration. I wasn't being literal. What they will be faced with is a problem of a constituent assembly, whoever is in a majority. They will unite on demanding a rapid end to the occupation, Iraqi control of Iraqi oil, and probably no military bases in Iraq. Which U.S. administration is going to accept that? I mean, they've been putting military bases in sort of, you know, these great countries all over Central Asia. The second thing I want to say is on Palestine. I think the Palestinians, what did Ariel Sharon, who was one of the most hardline leaders for regime change in Iraq, because they regarded the Iraqis as a regime which wasn't totally under the control of the West and therefore did help the Palestinians, not just the suicide bombers, but gave lots of money to the Palestinians. And he wanted this regime defeated because he also thought that the Iraqi army had the potential of intervening in the situation. And so there was massive pressure from Sharon. What did Sharon say the day after Baghdad fell? Now I hope you Palestinians will come to your senses because your great protector is dead. This is what I was referring to, the headman mentality, refusing to understand why people are resisting. But the actions of the Palestinians have created now a very big crisis in Israel. And I was incredibly touched to read in yesterday's British press, I don't know whether it's been reported in the US press as yet, that 10 Israeli Air Force pilots refused to fly bombing missions over Palestine, including Black Hawk helicopter pilots, and said, we are pilots and we are soldiers. We are not mafia men who go on hits for the purposes of revenge, which has created a crisis, a small crisis inside the
Do you believe George Bush, it would be better for the Palestinians, as Christopher Hitchens has
I don't proposed? Think so. There's no evidence
and
of that.
We're running out of time. I just want to get a yes or no answer from each of you. Christopher Hitchens, should the U.S. pull out of Iraq completely?
Certainly not. Not until it's overseen. Helped to oversee.
Tariq Ali, should the U.S. pull out entirely?
I think they should pull out immediately before more American lives and more Iraqi lives are lost, and let the Iraqi people determine their own future.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us for this hour. Christopher Hitchens, columnist with Vanity Fair, author of A Long Short War, The Postponed Liberation of Iraq, and Tariq Ali, author of Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. You can sign up there for our daily digest. Looking forward to seeing people in Baltimore this weekend, Saturday at night, on the anniversary of the death of Phil Berrigan at Peter Claver Church. That's Saturday at 7 in the evening. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Abdel Kanous, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pravesh Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.